firing in unison meant that she had discovered one of those coalitions. But what was its significance? Andreasen had remade Berger's discovery and, with the more sophisticated technology available to her, she was able to learn much more than he could about the network of brain structures involved and the type of activity taking place. However, Andreasen had just scratched the surface, and it wasn't until Reichel performed his more extensive research a few years later that the default network moved to center stage in the world of neuroscience research. In the past decade, scientists have discovered additional structures that contribute to the default network, and we are still working to better understand its role in the brain. But we do know that the default network governs our interior mental life, the dialogue we have with ourselves, both consciously and subconsciously. Kicking into gear when we turn away from the barrage of sensory input produced by the outside world, it looks toward our inner selves. When that happens, the neural networks of our elastic thought can rummage around the huge database of knowledge and memories and feelings that is stored in the brain, combining concepts that we would normally not associate and noting connections that we would normally not recognize. That's why resting, daydreaming, and other quiet activity, such as taking a walk, can be powerful ways to generate ideas. Smarts by association. The power of the default mode stems from its place of origin in the brain. The components of the default network are all within subregions of the brain called association cortices. We have an association cortex for each of our five sensory systems and for each motor region. And we have what are called higher order association areas for complex mental processes not associated with movement or the senses. I said in chapter 4 that neural networks that represent ideas can activate one another, creating associations. The association cortices are where those connections are made. Associations help to confer meaning on what you are seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, and touching. For example, a brain region called the primary visual cortex detects the basic features of the visual world, such as edges, light and dark, location, etc. But that is just data. What does the data mean? What persons, places, and things are you looking at, and what is their significance? It is an association cortex that defines the objects you identify. When you read a sign that says no trespassing, the printed letters create an image on your retina. That is just a reproduction of the lines that make up the letters. The sign's message achieves meaning only when that information is passed from the retina to the visual cortex to an association cortex that identifies the sign and the letters and words written on it. And that's just the beginning. The image is then passed on to other association regions where connotation, emotional tone, and your personal memories and experience give the words additional meaning. No one has firsthand knowledge of how other animals think. But scientists who observe them note that they seem to have little power to make abstract associations. Scientists can show, through elaborate experiments involving concrete objects, that rhesus monkeys can add one and one to get two. But to associate the abstraction of the moon's orbit with an ellipse seems to be beyond them. In humans, however, about three-quarters of our cerebral neurons reside in the association cortices. This, as a proportion of the brain, is far more than in any other animal. Our association neurons are what allow us to think and have ideas, rather than merely react. They are the source of our attitudes, differentiating us from one another and helping to define our identities as individuals. They are also the source of our inventiveness. Our culture tends to view discovery and innovation as materializing out of nothing, the product of the ethereal magic of a gifted intellect. But breakthrough ideas, like mundane ideas, often arise from the association and recombination of what is already lying around in the corners of our minds. That brings us back to the default mode. When your mind is at rest, what it is really doing is bouncing thoughts back and forth, Andreasen says. Your association cortices are always running in the background, but when you are not focused on some task, for example, when you are doing something mindless like driving, That's when your mind is most free to roam. That's why that is when you most actively create new ideas. As is often the case in neuroscience, one way to better understand the role of a structure or network in the brain is to study the behavior of people in which it is disrupted. Consider the famous case of patient J, who, due to a stroke in her frontal lobe, lost the functioning of her default mode, and then rather miraculously recovered. Immediately after her stroke, patient J lay in bed quietly and remained alert. She responded to requests and instructions and spoke in answer to speech, but she did not initiate any conversation. In the absence of the internal mental dialogue that produces associations, nothing came to mind. Think about a typical conversation. If her doctor asked, "How do you like the hospital food?" patient J might have answered, "It's not very good." A healthy individual might have followed up with something beyond that literal answer. She might have added, "If I wasn't in a hospital already, food like that could have landed me here." Or, "But it beats the mystery meat at my child's school cafeteria." But one could think of making such remarks only after retrieving private mental associations, such as bad food and food poisoning, or hospital food and school food. Answers like that don't come from the immediate surroundings or circumstances. They are expressions of your personality that require you to turn inward. Such thoughts were beyond patient J. She had lost the ability to generate new ideas, so she lost the ability to converse. After patient J recovered, she was asked about why she had never said anything except in response to questions. She replied that she didn't speak because she had, quote, "nothing to say." Her mind, she said, had been empty. The importance of being aimless. I had the pleasure of spending a few years working with Stephen Hawking. For the past 5 decades or so, Stephen has been living with ALS, a disease that attacks the neurons that control the voluntary muscles. Because he has little capacity for movement, Stephen communicates by choosing words from a computer screen through the clicks of a mouse. It's a tedious process. At first, the screen displays a cursor moving from letter to letter. Once he has selected a letter, through another click, he can either choose from a list of suggested words that begin with that letter, or he can repeat the process to choose the second letter of the word he has in mind, and so on, until he has chosen or spelled out the word. When we first began collaborating, he accomplished the mouse clicks by employing his thumb. Later, as the disease progressed, his glasses were fitted with a motion sensor so that he could click the mouse by twitching a muscle on his right cheek. If you have ever seen Stephen interviewed on television, the quickness with which he responds to the questions is an illusion. He receives the queries long in advance and requires days or weeks to fashion his answers. Then, when the interviewer asks the question, Stephen simply clicks his mouse to initiate the reading of his response, or the sound editor later adds it. When I worked with Stephen, he could compose his sentences at a rate of only about 6 words a minute. As a result, I would typically have to wait several minutes for him to make even a simple response to something I said. At first, I would sit impatiently, daydreaming on and off as I waited for him to finish his composition. But then one day, I was looking over his shoulder at his computer screen, where the sentence he was constructing was visible, and I started thinking about his evolving reply. By the time he had completed it, I had had several minutes to ponder the ideas he expressed. That incident led me to a revelation. In normal conversations, we are expected to reply to each other within seconds, and as a result, our volleys of speech come almost automatically, from a superficial place in our minds. In my conversations with Stephen, the stretching of those seconds to minutes had a hugely beneficial effect. It allowed me to more profoundly consider his remarks, and it enabled my own ideas and my reaction to his to percolate as they never can in ordinary conversations. As a result, the slowed pace endowed my exchanges with a depth of thought not possible in the rush of normal communication. That rush doesn't affect only in-person conversations. We rush to answer texts, pound out emails, flit from link to link online, We have more assistance from automation and technology than ever before, but we are also busier than ever before. We're bombarded with information, with decisions to make, with tasks on our to-do list, with the demands of work. Adults today typically access their smartphones for an average of 34 short sessions daily, 30 seconds or less, not to mention longer periods for phone calls, to play games, etc. 58% of adults check their phones at least every hour, while 18 to 24-year-olds exchange, on average, 110 text messages each day. The impact of technology can be positive. We are more connected to our friends and family. We have easy and almost constant access over cell phone or tablet to television shows, news websites, games, and other apps. But we are also expected to be available always and everywhere, and because we can work at home and are more connected to our employer, we may be expected to work or be on call virtually all the time. Even our connection to friends and family has a downside, for it can be addictive. In one study, in which participants were asked to refrain from texting for 2 days, they reported feeling annoyed, anxious, and agitated when unable to text those they were close to. In another study, iPhone users were found to suffer from anxiety and an increase in heart rate and blood pressure when they were prevented from answering their ringing phone. Another showed that 73% of smartphone users feel panicked if they misplace their phone. And yet another documented that many people can't help being on their phone, even when they know they shouldn't. These are classic signs of addiction, and such syndromes are becoming so serious and so common that psychiatrists have begun to fashion names for them, such as iPhone separation, nomophobia for no mobile phone phobia, or, more generally, eye disorders. Addiction occurs because the constant bombardment of activity that we've become accustomed to can change the function of our brains. The mechanism is much like that of chemical addiction. The fact that we don't know what we'll come across when we check our favorite social media site or our email produces anticipation in our brain. And when we find something of interest, we get a little surge in our reward circuitry. After a while, you become conditioned to the rush, and you get bored in its absence. Meanwhile, beeps, swishes, and harp notes continually remind us that a reward could be waiting. Remind you of the one-armed bandits in Las Vegas? Says David Greenfield, psychiatrist and founder of the Center for Internet and Technology Addiction. The internet is the world's largest slot machine, and the smartphone is the world's smallest slot machine. Video games, including those simple ones you can play on your phone, are even worse. To quote one study, a massive increase in the amount of dopamine released in the brain was indeed observed during video game play, in particular in areas thought to control reward and learning. The level of increase was remarkable, being comparable to that observed when amphetamines are injected intravenously. The result of our addiction to constant activity is a dearth of idle time, and hence, a dearth of time in which the brain is in its default mode. And though some may consider doing nothing unproductive, a lack of downtime is bad for our well-being, because idle time allows our default network to make sense of what we've recently experienced or learned. It allows our integrative thinking processes to reconcile diverse ideas without censorship from the executive brain. It allows us to mull over our desires and shuffle through our unattained goals. Those internal conversations feed our ongoing first-person narrative of life, and they help develop and reinforce our sense of self. They also allow us to connect divergent information to form new associations, and to step back from our issues and problems, to change the way we frame them, or to generate new ideas. That gives our bottom-up elastic thinking networks the opportunity to search for creative, unexpected solutions to tough problems. On the night she invented her character Frankenstein, had Mary Shelley possessed a cell phone, rather than resting and letting her thoughts wander, she might have reached for the device. Its many lures might have attracted her conscious attention and suppressed the emergence of her idea. The associative processes of elastic thinking do not thrive when the conscious mind is in a focused state. A relaxed mind explores novel ideas. An occupied mind searches for the most familiar ideas, which are usually the least interesting. Unfortunately, as our default networks are sidelined more and more, we have less unfocused time for our extended internal dialogue to proceed. As a result, we have diminished opportunity to string together those random associations that lead to new ideas and realizations. It's ironic, but the technological advancement that makes elastic thinking ever more essential also makes it less likely that we'll engage in it. And so, if we are to exercise the elastic thinking that is demanded by our fast-paced times, we have to fight the constant intrusions and find islands of time during which we can unplug. In the past few years, that issue has become so urgent that a relatively new field called eco-psychology has suddenly flourished. Eco-psychologists are gathering scientific evidence to back up their assertions, but many of the recommendations aren't new. For example, they suggest that one way to set aside dedicated quiet time is to disconnect and take refuge in activities like jogging or taking a shower. Walks are also useful, but you have to leave your cell phone at home. Such walks allow your default mode to kick in, and they help restore your top-down executive functions. When you get back to join the rat race, you'll be revitalized, but only if you walk in a quiet area. Noisy urban neighborhoods are filled with stimuli that capture and direct your attention. For example, when you need to avoid bumping into someone or getting hit by a speeding car. But if the act of walking or running can free your mind, so can taking a few minutes in the morning after you wake up to simply lie in bed. Don't think about your schedule that day or ponder your to-do list, but rather take advantage of your quiet state to stare at the ceiling, enjoy the comfort of your bed, and relax a little before popping up to face the world. At work, rather than always pushing on when you are stuck and unable to resolve some complex issue, you can schedule a bout of mindless tasks as a break. Keeping something as trivial as a shopping list in your mind can impede elastic thinking, so try to purge your thoughts of what you had been working on and of the things you still have to do. If you successfully clear your brain, you'll be getting some easy work done while simultaneously freeing your elastic mind to look for a breakthrough solution to your impasse. Even an hourly pause to walk to the water cooler can help. The interlude will give your elastic mind a chance to process and question what that last hour of concentrated thought produced. Surprisingly, procrastination can help too. Research shows a positive correlation between procrastination and creativity because by putting off conscious attempts to solve problems and make decisions, we provide ourselves more time to fit in those episodes of unconscious consideration. Leonardo da Vinci had such great respect for unconscious processing that while he was working on the Last Supper, he would sometimes suddenly quit for a while. The clergyman who was paying Leonardo did not appreciate those hiatuses. As art historian Giorgio Vasari put it, the prior of the church entreated Leonardo with tiresome persistence to complete the work, since it seemed strange to him to see how Leonardo sometimes passed half a day at a time lost in thought, and he would have preferred Leonardo, just like the laborers hoeing in the garden, never to have laid down his brush. But Leonardo talked to him extensively about art and persuaded him that the greatest geniuses sometimes accomplish more when they work less. The next time you stare out the window, remember, you aren't slacking off. You're giving your artistic side a chance to do its work. And if you don't tend to take such breaks, you might find it beneficial to make room for them. Chapter 7. The Origin of Insight. When the unimaginable becomes the self-evident. On December 21, 1941, 2 grim weeks after Pearl Harbor, President Franklin Roosevelt told his Joint Chiefs of Staff in a meeting at the White House that it was imperative that Japan be bombed as soon as possible, both to boost morale at home and to plant the seeds of doubt in the Japanese people, whose leaders had told them that they were invulnerable. Despite the urgency of the mission, It seemed like an impossible task. No bomber had anywhere near the range necessary to fly to Japan. One cold day a few weeks later, a submarine captain named Francis Lowe was reminded of Roosevelt's challenge as he watched bombers on practice runs at a naval airfield in Norfolk, Virginia. The rectangular outline of an aircraft carrier deck had been painted on a runway to provide the bombers their mock target. Like everyone else who'd been told about the challenge, Lowe had been drawing blanks. A lifelong Navy man and a submarine captain by training, bombers were far from his area of expertise. But as he watched the shadows of the planes cross that painted outline, an idea suddenly exploded into his consciousness. It was an idea an expert would have dismissed as absurd. What if they launched their bombers from the deck of a carrier? It was an instance in which the key to solving the problem was ignorance, or at least pretending that what you know isn't true. Lowe wasn't completely ignorant. He understood some of the many reasons his idea couldn't work, but he decided to ignore them. He instead embraced the assumption that it had to work, and began by analyzing how to overcome the obstacles. There were many such obstacles. Aircraft carriers are designed to transport nimble and lightweight fighters, not bombers, which are too heavy to take off from a carrier's limited runway. Bombers are also not very maneuverable, and hence are easy to shoot down, so they must be escorted by fighters. But an aircraft carrier hasn't the space to carry both. Most important, even if a bomber could somehow be placed on a carrier, and the carrier could take it close enough to Japan for it to be within bombing range, the high tail and weak tail structure of a bomber made it impossible to install a landing hook, and so the returning bombers would not be able to land on the carrier. Lowe didn't have most of the answers, but he didn't accept the prospect that none could be found. After returning to Washington, he went to see his commanding officer, Admiral Ernest King. Lowe was always uncomfortable in his superior's presence, and now he was especially nervous. His suggestion was bound to strike the stern admiral as outlandish. Lowe waited until King was alone, and then, during a pause in their conversation, he blurted out his idea. Though the scheme seemed unlikely to succeed, the times were desperate. So over the next months, bombers were stripped down to their bare essentials to reduce their weight and fitted with extra fuel tanks to extend their range. Pilots were trained to take off from a short carrier deck and to fly low enough to evade Japanese radar, eliminating the need for a fighter escort. And the problem of not being able to land on a carrier was solved by accepting the notion that, after dropping their bombs, the pilots could fly onward to land or ditch their planes in the Chinese or Soviet countryside. Those countries had denied the Americans permission to use their territories to stage and launch an attack, but if the planes were merely to land there, they would not even have to know about it. The crews of the ditched planes, unfortunately, would be left with the huge challenge of finding their own way to Allied lines. Army Air Force's Chief of Staff General Henry H. Arnold assigned the technically astute Colonel Jimmy Doolittle to organize and lead the raid, and Doolittle gathered 80 volunteers to man 16 B-25s for the mission. Because the idea that American bombers could reach Japan seemed so implausible, they encountered almost no anti-aircraft fire. In fact, many Japanese on the ground waved to them, thinking they were part of a practice mission conducted by their own Air Force. All told, the planes dropped 16 tons of bombs on Japan, mostly on the Tokyo area. After the raid, the crews of all the planes either crash-landed or bailed out in provincial China. All but six of the crewmen survived. To grasp how absurd Lowe's idea must have seemed to the experts of the day, consider this. The Japanese, desperate to eliminate the risk of any more such raids, found it unimaginable that the planes had been carrier-based. They became convinced that the attack had come from Midway Atoll, the only possible land source, and they sent their fleet there to take that island. The U.S. Navy, one step ahead, was lying in wait and sank all but one of their carriers. The Japanese fleet was essentially crippled, a setback that military historian John Keegan called the most stunning and decisive blow in the history of naval warfare. Sometimes the most powerful revelation one can have is that circumstances have changed, that the rules you are accustomed to no longer apply, that the successful tactics may be tactics that would have been rejected under the old rules. That can be liberating. It can spur you to question your assumptions and help you rise above your fixed paradigms and restructure your thinking. In this case, an aircraft carrier was a piece in a standard war planning puzzle. So too was a bomber. Under normal circumstances, those pieces didn't fit together. It took Lo to recognize that, in the aftermath of Pearl Harbor, the puzzle had changed. A course of action that clearly didn't fit the game of conventional warfare was appropriate to the demands of that moment in history. History and ordinary human life is full of opportunities missed by not recognizing that change has occurred and that the previously unthinkable is now doable. When asked how he had come to his plan, Lo said it was fortuitous, as if he'd walked into a Chinese restaurant and found his idea written in a fortune cookie. No doubt that's how his conscious mind perceived it. But today we know that insights like Lo's are not accidental. They are the result of a complex process that your unconscious brain engages in after your conscious logical reasoning, constrained by commonly accepted rules and conventions, fails you. In the last chapter, we learned about the default network and saw that our brains are at work making associations even when we are not consciously focused on anything in particular. Most of those associations never reach our conscious awareness. In Lo's case, desperation pushed his mind to consider a last resort, an idea that would otherwise have been rejected. Here, we will explore the mechanism that brings those associations into your consciousness, and what determines whether the ideas presented to your awareness are mere conventional notions or brilliantly original insights. Splitting the brain. Roger Sperry pondered what he had found. It was the late 1950s. He had been experimenting on animals, on which he had previously operated to sever the corpus callosum, the structure that sits between the brain's right and left halves. He was aware that most of his colleagues thought his work was a waste of time, that the corpus callosum played an uninteresting mechanical role in the brain. They considered it a kind of girdle that kept the hemispheres from sagging. Sperry envisioned a grander function, allowing the right and left hemispheres to communicate, and now, with his discovery, he had astonished even himself. The conventional wisdom was that the communication between the hemispheres was largely unnecessary. The left side of the brain was seen as being responsible for cerebral functions ranging from understanding language to arithmetic reasoning to controlling willful movement. The right hemisphere, by contrast, was said to be generally lacking in higher cognitive function, mute and unable to talk or write, even in left-handed individuals. As a result, doctors commonly told patients who had a stroke damaging the right side of their brain that they were lucky, because that hemisphere doesn't do much. Some of Sperry's colleagues even refer to the right side of the brain as being, quote, relatively retarded. Given that, why would communication between the hemispheres be important? Sperry wasn't buying the conventional wisdom. It was based on the observation of patients with brain lesions, and he didn't trust that research, because scientists had little control over it. Patients never walked in with damage to exactly the brain structure one wished to study. Sperry reasoned he could do better. Employing his excellent skills as a laboratory surgeon, he could excise precise regions of a brain and observe changes to behavior due to that exact deficit, though only in animals, of course. And that's exactly what he did to investigate the role of the corpus callosum. He surgically severed that structure. An animal that's undergone this procedure is said to have a, quote, split brain. At first, Sperry had been disappointed. He found, just as everyone warned him would be the case, that the surgery had little effect on the animal's day-to-day behavior. But then, he designed a new battery of tests to isolate the individual hemispheres from each other more carefully. It was the results of those experiments that now astonished him. In one experiment, Sperry covered one eye of split-brained cats. As they viewed the world through the uncovered eye, he taught them to discriminate between a triangle and a square. Geometry is not a cat's best subject, but they eventually became good at the task. Then Sperry switched the covering to the other eye and again tested the cats. Did the opposite hemisphere benefit from the training? Sperry found that, with the corpus callosum cut, cats were, quote, unable to perform with one eye a visual pattern discrimination learned with the other. By severing the corpus callosum, he had precluded the communication between hemispheres. Through a series of careful experiments such as that, Sperry learned that he could interact independently with each hemisphere of an animal's brain, and he found them to be startlingly self-sufficient when it came to processing information. Each of the divided hemispheres, he would later write, has its independent mental sphere or cognitive system, its own independent perceptual, learning, memory, and other mental processes. It's as if each hemisphere is unaware of what is experienced in the other. In other words, Sperry claimed, the animals seem to have two minds within them. Their individual capabilities and potential for independent thought are not normally apparent, for in a healthy individual, the minds are highly connected through the corpus callosum and work in harmony. But when you sever that connection, they reveal their individual selves. Sperry viewed his results as revolutionary, but others didn't see them that way. They believed that his conclusions were valid only for, quote, lower animals. Sperry knew that his challenge was to prove that it worked the same in humans. But how? He couldn't exactly haul a human into the lab and sever the corpus callosum the way he did with animals. That's when Joseph Bogan, a neurosurgeon, showed Sperry an essay on epilepsy he had written called A Rationale for Splitting the Human Brain. In the 1940s, surgeons had experimented with severing the corpus callosum in order to reduce the fury of seizures in patients with severe epilepsy, and Bogan was thinking about resurrecting that approach. He suggested that if he were to perform any of those surgeries, perhaps Sperry would like to study his patients. It was just the break Sperry needed. In 1962, Bogan operated on the first of a series of 16 patients he would invite Sperry to test. The results of those studies confirmed what Sperry had found in his animal studies, that the conventional wisdom about the roles of the hemispheres was wrong. The two hemispheres of our brains are something like independent beings. For example, in one case, a patient was asked how many seizures she'd had recently. Her right hand shot up and showed two fingers, indicating that she'd had that number of seizures. Her left hand, controlled by the opposite cerebral hemisphere, pulled the right hand down. Then her left hand rose and indicated just one. Her right hand went up again, and the two hands tangled, fighting each other like angry children. Eventually, the patient said that her maverick left hand often did things on its own. By naming the left hand as a maverick, the patient seemed to be taking the side of her right. That's because the right hand is controlled by the brain's left hemisphere, which also controls speech. This illustrates an important point. Though the right hemisphere is not, as prevailing thought put it, quote, retarded, the two hemispheres do have some different capabilities. For example, though the right hemisphere can comprehend spoken words, it cannot speak them. So when a split-brain patient talks, it is the left hemisphere that is expressing itself. Understanding those hemispheric differences would later prove to be the key to understanding the origin of ideas like the sudden insight experienced by Francis Lowe. But in Sperry's day, scientists were skeptical, and as word spread, the new research quickly became controversial. After all, it not only challenged long-held scientific ideas, it could also threaten philosophical or even theological beliefs. Is the notion that each of us is an I an illusion? If there are two beings within us, does that mean that we are each two people or have two souls? Those aren't questions that science concerns itself with, but Bogan didn't want to subject himself to possible devastating attacks by scientists or anyone else. He asked to withdraw his name from Sperry's publications. The work, however, stood the test of time, and Sperry received the Nobel Prize for it in 1981. Sperry died in 1994, about 3 decades after his groundbreaking research. During those years, scientists continued to explore the roles of the two hemispheres, but progress was slow. Sadly, it was shortly after Sperry died that the pace picked up because of the availability of fMRI and other new brain imaging technologies. The past two decades have seen an explosion in understanding regarding the roles of the two hemispheres and the structures within them. And in recent years, one startling conclusion of that research is that a certain structure in the once-derided right hemisphere has a special talent for generating the original ideas that are in great demand when an organism is confronted with novelty or change or a seemingly intractable intellectual challenge. The connection between language and problem solving. The origin of new ideas is one of the concerns of the field of cognitive psychology, the study of how we human beings think. Until relatively recently, scientists could draw their conclusions only from the indirect evidence provided by behavioral studies and through guesswork. But during the 1990s, the field gave birth to a new kind of science called cognitive neuroscience, which employed evidence derived from the new brain imaging technologies. The field's pioneers aimed to use those instruments to study the physical processes in the brain that produce our thoughts, feelings, and behavior, and to understand how they are related to each other and how we can manipulate them. The new technologies, they recognized, offer the power not only to understand the way we think, but to help us change it. One of those pioneers was John Kunios, then a young assistant professor at Tufts University. Kunios focused on employing a technology to study what are called ERPs, to investigate how the brain processes language. The acronym stands for Event-Related Potentials, the electrical activities in the brain that result from an internal or external stimulus. It had been known since Berger's work that you can measure ERPs employing Berger's EEG, but the new technology coupled that with powerful computers to create a far more precise picture. One day, while analyzing the timing of neural activity as the brain strives to understand the meanings of words and sentences, Kunios' own brain made a new association. He suddenly saw an analogy between the processes involved in understanding the meaning of a sentence and the elastic thinking required to forge a response to a daunting mental challenge, the kind of thinking that had led Lowe to his grand idea during World War II, or that you might employ to react to a new circumstance in life or to solve a riddle or an intellectual puzzle. How are sentences like puzzles? Each sentence is an ordered list of words and punctuation. But most words have multiple meanings, and those meanings can combine in different ways, depending upon the grammar and context. That's the puzzle, to choose among the various definitions of the individual words in such a way that the whole sentence has meaning, a meaning that fits into the larger context if there is one. It's really an exercise in integrative thinking. Rather than try to decide the meaning of each word as it is spoken, your brain keeps the whole sentence and the larger context in mind while making sense of the words. To accomplish that, as we hear or read each word, we hold its possible definitions in our working memory, while our brain processes the other words of the sentence and considers their range of definitions. Only at the end do we put it all together. For example, consider the sentence, "The cooking teacher said the young children made bad snacks." When you heard that, your unconscious mind quickly sorted through the various meanings of all the words and chose the appropriate ones. Now listen to this sentence. "The cannibal said the young children made bad snacks." Chances are this time you assigned a different meaning to the word "made." This sentence differs from the prior one by only one word, but that word alters the context and hence your brain's interpretation of the words that follow. Similarly, as a best-selling book on the importance of grammar pointed out a few years ago, when you hear the phrase, "eat shoots and leaves," you understand one meaning for the word "shoots and leaves," but if commas are added so that it's read, "eats, shoots, and leaves," then you assign the words a different meaning. One of the amazing things about the human brain is that when we hear or read sentences, the appropriate meanings come to mind quickly and without conscious effort. But it's only because we have a brain with an unconscious tuned to doing that, thanks to millions of years of evolution that provided our cerebral hardware and the many thousands of hours of exposure to our native language that allowed us to program it. You get an appreciation of how great a gift that is any time you listen to or read a language that you don't know well. That task is slow and effortful because your unconscious hardware is not yet trained, and you must consciously puzzle out word meanings. In the 1950s, when the digital computer was still a new invention, and information scientists thought that artificial intelligence would soon rival that of humans, computer linguists vastly underestimated the power of our unconscious language processing. They thought it would be easy to program a computer to replicate it. Their lack of success is illustrated by the story of an early computer that translated the homily, "The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," into Russian and then back into English, and obtained, "The vodka is strong, but the meat is rotten." Before it was converted to the neural net approach, Google Translate still made analogous mistakes. The Trial of the Hemispheres. When Kunios became curious about how the brain's language comprehension ability might relate to other kinds of problem solving, he began scanning the existing literature. There, he found a lot of work in which psychologists had arranged to show various intellectual challenges to just one side of the brain or just the other, as Sperry had done in his cat experiments. These scientists had uncovered intriguing hints that the right hemisphere played a special role in generating imaginative ideas, but those papers relied on the self-reports of their subjects to determine what they were thinking. Unfortunately, many people's self-knowledge doesn't extend much beyond recognizing when they want a beer. As a result, even when biases are not in play, self-reporting can be unreliable. How unreliable? The habit of drawing conclusions without really knowing why we make them bothered me when I worked for a season as a writer on the staff of Star Trek: The Next Generation. Unlike my personal choices, or those I made in my physics research, the choices we made on that television series could have a big effect on people. For example, when we bought or rejected script submissions or made judgments about casting. And so, those times I participated in casting decisions, I would always ask what the producer or producers saw in the chosen actor or actress. They'd say things like, "He has a presence." To that, my literal analytical mind would ask, "What does that mean? Who doesn't have a presence? Only someone who didn't show up for the audition, right?" In hindsight, I realized that the descriptors the producers gave portrayed a connection they felt on the unconscious level. The source of the connection, however, was usually difficult for them to articulate. Based on what scientists have discovered in the decades since, we now know that the architecture of your brain puts out of reach the behind-the-scenes influence that your unconscious mind exerts on your thinking. As a result, though introspection can help illuminate aspects of conscious reasoning, of analytical problem solving, it cannot provide much insight into elastic thinking. Yet it is those subliminal elastic processes that Kunios suspected led to moments of insight that are so famous in the annals of discovery and innovation, and in the revelatory moments of our lives. As a result, despite dozens of behavioral studies, as long as the research relied on self-reports, the science of insight hardly progressed. Before we get too far into the science of insight, it is helpful to take a moment to consider what cognitive psychologists mean by idea and insight. In normal parlance, an idea can be a composite, developed over a long period of time and made of many component notions, as in the idea of the quantum. In the science of thinking, however, an idea usually refers to something simpler, the complexity of which can be contained in a single thought, and that pops suddenly into our consciousness. An insight is defined as an idea of that sort that represents an original and fruitful way of understanding an issue or approaching a problem. "The origin of insight was a fascinating puzzle," says Kunios, "and I knew that it could be important for people's economic success. Yet for some reason, there were virtually no neuroscience studies on it back then. That was good because my lab was a small one, and the big, well-funded labs have a huge advantage. They had better equipment and more people, and could crank out work very fast. But they weren't working on insight." And so Kunios made the fateful decision that for the next phase of his career, he would work to understand those moments, employing the technological tools he had used to study the neural activity of decoding sentences. At the same time that John Kunios was starting to focus on the physiological basis for insight, a few hundred miles away, at the National Institutes of Health, so was Mark Beeman. Like Kunios, Beeman studied language processing. And like Kunios, he had read about Sperry's pioneering work in college and was surprised at how many people continued to ignore the role of the brain's right hemisphere. Like the skeptics in Sperry's day, their lack of interest was based on the observation of stroke patients and others with right hemisphere brain injuries. Those patients' mental deficits were often more subtle than the deficits of patients with left hemisphere damage, but Beeman was convinced that they were significant. For example, people with certain left hemisphere damage lose their speech capability, while those with right hemisphere damage don't. But people with right hemisphere damage do have some language issues. Although they can still speak, they have trouble understanding jokes and metaphors and finding the theme of the story or drawing inferences, says Beeman. To Beeman, those issues were the key to understanding the right hemisphere's role. What did those language deficits have in common? What does getting a joke have to do with understanding a metaphor? Like Kunios, Beeman thought about how our brains puzzle out language. After you encounter a word, and your unconscious pulls up all of its various possible meanings, it determines the probability that each meaning might be appropriate to the sentence under consideration. The most obvious and common meanings start with the highest probabilities. As you hear more of a sentence, those probabilities are updated according to the context. The associations you attach to the meanings of words play an important role in that process. As you hear a sentence, your brain looks for where the associations of all the words in the sentence overlap, and it uses that information to make its best guess regarding what the speaker is trying to get across. For example, in the case of the sentence, "The cooking teacher said the young children made bad snacks," the context associated with cooking teacher tells your brain that the appropriate meaning for the phrase "made bad snacks" has to do with the creation of food. On the other hand, when you read the sentence, "The cannibal said the young children made bad snacks," the context associated with cannibal tells you that "made bad snacks" has to do with being eaten as food. Although those are the most probable and obvious interpretations of each of those sentences, they could have been construed the other way. The author of the sentence, "The cooking teacher said the young children made bad snacks," could conceivably have meant that the cooking teacher had just eaten the kids as a snack, and the author of "The cannibal said the young children made bad snacks" might conceivably have wanted to convey that the cannibal disdained the children's cooking ability. Your unconscious mind noted those possibilities, but it probably didn't make you aware of those unlikely interpretations. Psychologists call them remote. Before an idea passes to your awareness, your brain conducts a kind of trial in which it considers all the evidence for the various meanings your unconscious mind has produced. Only then does it pass to your consciousness what it has deemed to be its best guess. As your brain weighs the meanings, its two hemispheres slug things out. Your left hemisphere advocates for the obvious and literal meanings, while your right hemisphere takes on the underdogs, the meanings that at first may seem remote, a bit of a stretch, but that are sometimes the correct interpretation. Beeman realized that when you look at the roles of the hemispheres that way, the language deficits of patients with damage to their right hemisphere make sense. Take metaphors. They are figures of speech in which a word or phrase that usually means one thing is used to mean another. The word "light" usually refers to the electromagnetic phenomenon, but in "the light of my life," it means joy or happiness. The word "heart" usually refers to the organ, but in "broken heart," it denotes an emotional state. When you understand the metaphor, it's because your right brain advocated the kind of fuzzy associations that allow you to understand these expressions, which explains why, if you had a stroke in the language center of your right brain, you wouldn't be able to understand metaphors. Jokes often rely on a similar process. Consider this from my monologue by Conan O'Brien. It's being reported that, because of the birth of his baby daughter, Chris Brown has decided to stop calling women hoes in his music. He says he's going to go with a more traditional term, bitch. The term traditional normally conjures the context of a long-established culture, even ancient or religious practices. By contrast, the use of the word bitch in hip-hop circles to refer generically to any woman is relatively recent. So this joke would confuse your left brain. When traditional is understood in the usual way, bitch is a non sequitur. But your right brain gets it. It allows a broader, fuzzier interpretation of the term traditional, one that allows for sarcasm. Beeman was impressed by the fuzzy logic capability of the right brain, and curious about whether it might have applications outside of language processing. And then it struck me, he says, I realized that the right hemisphere's role in insight is like its role in language. He and Kunios were now both headed in the same direction. The Lessons of Crap, C-R-A-P. Kunios and Beeman finally crossed paths in late 2000. Kunios had conducted his studies of ERPs using the EEG, but Beeman had learned the new fMRI technology. In determining timing, the EEG is far superior, but fMRI provides more precise maps of brain structure and activation, exactly what the EEG isn't good at. When we thought about that, Kunios told me, that's when it clicked. We realized that, working together, we could say both when and where things happen. They agreed to be partners. Kunios and Beeman decided to design a set of parallel studies. They would each recruit their own subjects and record their brain responses in their own labs, employing their respective technologies. But they would present the subjects in both labs with the same puzzles. In that way, Kunios could nail down the timing of brain responses and Beeman the geography. By combining their data, they would obtain a complete picture of which brain structures are activated, as well as how they are orchestrated. Kunios and Beeman sought to design a word game that could be solved through either unconscious insight or conscious analytical reasoning. They decided to use a kind of brain teaser, patterned after the riddles in what psychologists called the Remote Associates Test, or RAT, RAT. They called their variants Compound Remote Association Problems, or CRA, shortening the more obvious choice of acronym, because, although some research can be described by that word, nobody wants it to appear in their papers. Here's how their CRAs work. Subjects are shown three words, for example, pine, crab, and sauce. They are asked to think of a solution word, a fourth word that can form a familiar compound word or phrase when appended to each of these three words. The solution word can come either before or after the given words. For example, consider the word nut. Pine nut works, as does nut sauce. But neither crab nut nor nut crab makes sense, so nut cannot serve as a solution word. It will help you appreciate the mental process Kunios and Beeman monitored in their respective labs if you try to solve the pine, crab, sauce CRA yourself. Their subjects solved only 59% of the puzzles, so don't worry if you don't succeed. It's getting a feel for the process that's important. So I'll give you a few seconds to think about it. What goes with the words pine, crab, and sauce? Kunios and Beeman designed the puzzle so that two of the three words bring up strong and obvious associations. In this case, pine seems to imply a type of tree, so words like cone, to make pine cone, and tree, to make pine tree, come to mind. Crab brings to mind the crustacean, so words like cake, which gives you crab cake, and meat, which gives you crab meat, quickly flash into consciousness. But since none of those words combine well with both of the other words, you come to realize that the solution probably has nothing to do with either trees or crustaceans. In other words, to solve this puzzle, you must let go of your immediate association of pine with trees and crab with crustaceans, and let weaker, less obvious, remote associations come into play. That's what makes it hard, but that's what insight is all about, making the unusual associations through elastic thinking that analytical thinking can discover only with difficulty. It's possible to attack this puzzle through conscious analytical thinking. You start, say, with crab, and generate an associate of the word, such as crab cake. If, as in this example, your word cake does not form a word or phrase with pine or with sauce, you try again and keep trying until the solution word is hit upon. But that can prove to be a very laborious process. On the other hand, those who use insight allow their minds to relax and wander until they find the answer, an idea that seems to appear suddenly from nowhere. In this case, that solution word is apple. Pineapple, crabapple, applesauce. In the Kuhnels-Biemann experiments, the subjects are given 30 seconds for each trial. Most employed insight in some of the trials and analytical reasoning in others, though despite the short time allotted, some also switched their approach in the midst of a trial. In each case, the subjects reported which method had led them to the solution. About 40% more puzzles were solved using insight than using logical analysis, and it was the thought processes leading to these solutions that Kuhnels and Biemann sought to understand. Biemann's subjects solved their CRAs while lying inside an fMRI machine. Kuhnels solved theirs while sitting in a stiflingly hot lab in which the air conditioning was broken, wearing a kind of shower cap that anchored the dozens of electrodes that Kuhnels attached to the subject's scalp and face. The subject's sweat kept interfering with the readings, remembers Kuhnels, but it was worth it, because the experiment would become a classic. The results they discovered illuminated, as never before, the mental processes that produce human insight. Deconstructing the insight process. What Kuhnels and Biemann discovered surprised everyone. The headline is that, although our conscious experience of the moment of insight is sudden, it comes from a long string of behind-the-scenes events that mirror the processes involved in understanding language, and with a similar division of labor among the right and left hemispheres. Here is how Kuhnels and Biemann deconstruct the insight process, whether in word games such as their CRA puzzles or in other domains. When you are presented with a problem, the brain begins to sort through possible solutions, just as it sorts through the possible meanings of a word in a sentence. That occurs quickly and outside of your consciousness. Your left brain makes the obvious associations and raises all the obvious answers. Your right brain searches for the obscure associations and the oddball answers. To be precise, Kuhnels and Biemann found that the oddball answers arise from increased neural activity in a fold of brain tissue just above the right ear, called the right anterior superior temporal gyrus, or ASTG. The different approaches taken by the right and left hemispheres of your brain illustrate the wisdom of Sperry's observation, more than half a century earlier, that they are like two independent cognitive systems. Deep within your unconscious mind, each hemisphere battles to have its ideas accepted by the jury of your executive brain and passed to your conscious awareness. But it seems that there is also a judge who can influence the proceedings. It is a mysterious brain structure that neuroscientists call the anterior cingulate cortex, or ACC, which lies just above the corpus callosum. One role of the ACC is to monitor other brain regions. I call it a judge because, though the science isn't yet settled, scientists theorize that when the right and left brain are taking their different approaches to a problem, the ACC may step in and act to control the relative strength to which the two hemispheres are heard. When you first consider a problem, your executive brain gives you a narrow focus. It ignores odd ideas and directs your conscious awareness toward the tried and true, the literal, the logical, or most obvious of the possible answers your associative brain produces. The left brain's guesses thus tend to come to your awareness first. That makes sense because ordinary or unoriginal ideas are usually sufficient. According to the scientist's theory, if those initial ideas don't lead to an answer, your ACC broadens the scope of your attention, loosening your focus on the conventional ideas of your left hemisphere and allowing the more original ones being proposed by the right to surface. Roughly speaking, your ACC accomplishes that by arranging for the right visual cortex, the part of your right hemisphere responsible for processing visual information, to shut down This is like closing your eyes so you can concentrate when you